Today, spend, spend, spend in 2023. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Friday afternoon, Tarek Brooker's with me again. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you, mate?
Yeah, pretty good. So we're coming towards the end of the year and, we look as though we're facing into a difficult 2023.
Yeah, it sort of feeds into what we've been talking about here for a while now, that a lot of people are going to face a very difficult 2023. People, you know, reverting from fixed to variable mortgages, you know, people just falling behind because of the rising cost of living outstripping wages growth. But yeah, and then on the other end of the spectrum, apparently we have a champagne shortage, mate. So, you know, it's all a little bit French Revolution.
Well, you know, as I said in the title, spend, 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 right? We are still spending, and the predictions are that Christmas will be quite a big spend. But it's interesting, if you look at the savings ratio, that's come down. People clearly are putting more on credit cards. The interest rates are rising. The equity drawdowns continue. I mean, it's the same old, same old, only more so. The question is, of course, at what point does the overall economy fall over? And if it does, what happens? Or will the RBA go on putting the rates up even more? I'm chuckling with all of the various opinions out there, from hardly at all through to more than 4%. You know, you can pretty much make it up as you go along.
Yeah, the divergence really is something, isn't it? I mean, because on one hand, you've got people who are just like, well, the RBA is basically done. You know, like, I believe, you know, that's the sort of, you know, I'm pretty sure Shane Oliver's pretty much out on a limb by himself at this point on that one. In terms of, like, you know, the major bank economists, CBA recently upped their prediction to 3.35 after the RBA's statement was a little bit less dovish than they thought. But then, you know, you've got people like Goldman talking about 4.1% next year. So it's going to be interesting.
And I think it just really highlights again that nobody really quite knows what's going on, because there are so many variables and so many uncertainties. But nevertheless, the data is actually quite potent when you start looking at the charts, isn't it? So maybe we should get into it and try and make sense of, well, what we can make sense of.
Yeah, sounds good. All righty. As usual, all the charts are available at avidcom.substack.com. If you want to support my work, you can do it through that. And, you know, without any further ado, let's get into it. Now, there's been a lot of talk about Aussie inflation over the last couple of weeks, with the ABS monthly new preliminary monthly figure coming in weaker than expected. Now, that came with, well, shall we say, more than a few disclaimers. You know, the ABS has come out and they have said repeatedly that the data is not entirely representative of what is exactly is going on. Only about 62% of it is actually updated. But that hasn't stopped quite a few people, including the RBA, with running with that number for the monthly data, which is lower than the quarterly figure. And part of that was also the fact that they fiddled with the weights to make rents and utility prices less weighted in the CPI. However, the Melbourne Institute inflation gauge, which some, including some of the people who are now calling for, you know, rates to be paused in the past, have said that this is a relatively good forward indicator of where the ABS will find inflation in the next few months. That recently recorded its third highest month-on-month reading on record. So I think it's worth sort of keeping that in mind going forward, that we could see a reacceleration of inflationary pressures into the new year.
Yeah, I did chuckle a bit when the RBA quoted the monthly figure, which, of course, we know is rubbery. And in fact, the ABS says don't use the monthly figure, use the quarterly figure, because that's more robust. And about half of the adjustment was, as you say, because of reweightings, right? Because it was, what, 7.3% previously. Well, at least, you know, half of the change was actually because they weighted down critical elements. So you can't really take that, you know, really seriously at the moment. But there was a lot of people saying, whoopee, we've hit the sweet spot, inflation's coming down. Just remember, the RBA is still expecting inflation to hit 8%.
Yeah, and you know, Treasury hasn't changed their forecast, etc. I mean, considering the fact that the weights have been changed, then yes, obviously, you know, there is going to be some degree of of change at some point. I mean, like personally, I'd be revising my personal inflation forecast down by, you know, the weight change, because obviously it's going to be a big deal. And it's going to be a particularly a big deal next year when those rental price increases start feeding in, because apparently this year Australians are spending less on rent, according to the ABS. But if you ask, you know, Louis Christopher at SQM, you ask them CoreLogic, Domain, REA, well, they've got quite a different story.
Yeah, well, certainly rental stress on my cash flow measure is still very, very high. It's worse than mortgage stress. And I've had a number of anecdotal stories from people over the last few weeks where they've had significant rental increases. And the sticky decision then is, well, do they just roll with it and pay more, or do they try and look for something else? And then they look for something else and discover you can't find anything else unless you go a long way out. So it really does highlight that the rental story is far from over. And yet it's not coming into the numbers yet. So I suspect it probably will next year, which will be one of those upside surprises potentially.
Yeah, I have a feeling that we're going to see, I mean, like obviously you can't keep seeing these huge, huge increases in the cost of building a new house. And that has been one of the major drivers of the CPI here in Australia over the last 12 months. And that will obviously come down over time. I mean, when I say come down in terms of its contribution to accelerating the CPI, but I have a feeling that rents are going to take over that role somewhat as rental price increases do feed in them. And that's something that we'll get into a little bit more on later in the show.
Yeah, and the base effect, of course, means that the old ones drop off and the new ones come in. So it's going to be a sort of it depends sort of story. But I have to say, I think the 8% is probably going to drift over into the beginning of next year. And then, of course, well, how far will it come down, if it comes down, and how quickly will it come down? And even if it comes down a bit, of course, the RBA is still in the situation where they can't afford to take rates lower until they're significantly convinced that it really is coming through, which I would suggest is quite some months down the track, despite the fact that there are some pundits out there talking about the RBA cutting rates early next year, which I find quite surprising.
I don't find it surprising.
the property pundits.
I find that it doesn't fit with the data, but I don't find it at all surprising. Did you happen to see the recent, it was literally only put out about less than an hour ago by Bill Evans from Westpac on Westpac's changed outlook for the economy and everything? Have you happened to have read that by any chance?
I had a quick glance. I didn't read it all, but yeah.
Yeah, I'm just going to read a few little bits.
Yeah, worth doing. Yep.
Okay, Westpac chief economist Bill Evans is out with his forecast for 2023. They continue to forecast a slowdown in the growth profile to just a growth of 1% in 2023. They see household consumption to slow from around 2% to near zero in the second half of 2023. The first half will benefit from the spillover of momentum in the second half of 2022, which is expected to come in around about 4%. Consistent with a depressing outlook for domestic sales, this is Bill Evans' words, not mine, and the expiry of tax allowances in June, business equipment investment is forecast to contract by around 7% in the second half of 2023. That will hit second half of 2023 with a compounded contraction in new residential investment and home renovation activity. A six-month period of stagnant economy and no growth in household spending will alert the RBA to ease policy settings in 2024. The sharp economic slowdown in 2023 will be partly engineered by the need for the RBA to continue lifting the cash rate in the first half of 2023 as wages growth and inflation remain uncomfortably high. I think that sums it up pretty well from old Bill Evans.
Pretty good. Yep. And yeah. It really does highlight the trajectory of higher rates, certainly in the first half of the year, slowing growth, more pressure on households, and therefore, by implication, probably more falls for home prices.
Indeed. And I think it's also worth noting that despite the fact that they're basically calling a per capita recession, they're not calling the fact that rates will be cut next year as many others are. And I think that really just, I think that puts Westpac relatively speaking in lockstep with the likes of the Bank of Canada and the RBA, not the RBA, the RBNZ. Yeah. Oh, wow, that was a mess. Anyway.
Freudian slip, I think you'd call that.
Well, you know, perhaps it's wishful thinking on my part. But, you know, you've got the Bank of Canada talking about the economy in Canada stalling as, you know, inflationary pressures hit, as higher rates hit. You've got the RBNZ talking about a recession in New Zealand. And I think that that's, you know, they're basically talking about the very real costs of containing inflation. And that's what happens when you, when you're forced to contain inflation from such a high level. You know, an economic downturn is nearly always results. So, well, not nearly always, it always results. So, you know, I think it's rather interesting that the RBA still thinks they're going to be able to get out of this one without a downturn. I mean, maybe if China stimulates, that could come to the rescue, but it's going to be tough for the, you know, to come to the rescue of this particular domestic economy without something external, because we are already enjoying quite an external boost from the war in Ukraine and the high commodity prices that are resulting from that.
I think it's they define it as a narrow path. Well, I reckon it's precipitous, right? And it's, don't look down. And it's worth, you know, remember that New Zealand and Canada is now above 4% cash rate.
Yeah, well, are they both at 4.25 at this point, I believe?
They're definitely above 4. I can't remember where it is. 4.1. But anyway, the point is we are dragging the chain in terms of lifting interest rates. And yet we've got probably one of the most buoyant economies because of the international trade and, as you say, the impact on the, you know, the conflicts and things like that. So the commodities. So we should be more insulated, or in other words, there could be more momentum in the local economy because of it. So actually, maybe our interest rate should be significantly higher.
Well, there is certainly that argument. I mean, if you look at, say, for example, like the US CPI, that is going to be dragged on by, you know, you're starting to see rents start to rental growth in terms of new rents starting to come down a little bit. And not only that, but you're also going to see the used car story play out in the next, you know, 12, 18, 24 months, depending on how long it takes. And I think that that's something that's also going to play out in Canada, because used cars are a significant part of their CPI as well. So there's going to be all these factors in, you know, the Canadian CPI, in the US CPI, even New Zealand, which has arguably seen their CPI peak. We are going to be lagging behind that, and we don't have those factors. They're going to put those, that same downward pressure on our inflation as the Canadians and the Americans. So there is a scenario in which, you know, taking, you know, Europe out of the equation, because obviously they're a basket case with all the energy price issues, but looking at, you know, the rest of the Western world, where we could have the highest inflation. So, you know, then playing at the kiddie pool in the, you know, the kiddie pool end of things in terms of, you know, raising rates relative to our peers, you know, it may not look like the best decision in hindsight.
Well, that's exactly right. And, the only other countervailing argument is, well, yeah, but our debt is a lot higher here, so households are more leveraged and therefore maybe there's more pain. But I'm not sure that's a very good argument for trying to tackle the inflation story.
Well, I mean, not only that, but, you know, the Kiwis and the Canadians really aren't that far behind us either. I mean, the Kiwis, for example, I mean, like, you know, okay, they have less debt than us, but their rates have gone even higher than ours by quite a significant margin. We're not talking about a little bit either. Yeah.
No,
you know, so I would imagine that their debt burden at that level of rates is probably greater than ours is, even if we raise rates by another, you know, 0.25%, 0.5%, just because it is that much higher. And also, you know, they still don't have the impact of the TFF hold off, you know, still, you know, flowing into benefiting the banks.
Absolutely, by a substantial amount.
Indeed. Should probably get onto the next chart. That's only the first one. Okay, we're just talking about the issue of rents. Now, SQM on a combined capital city average basis sees rents up 24.7%. Now, the reason why I go for the capital city average is because that's what the ABS does when they do their data. They don't do regionals, they do capital cities, and that's the way the metric works. And if that flows fully into the CPI next year, well, that's going to make hitting the 3% inflation target pretty difficult, even just with the regular underlying pressures present in the economy in a normal year, let alone the way things are now.
Yeah, and it's worth reflecting that there's quite a variation, right? If you look at you know, the capital cities versus some of the regions, and I was listening to somebody this morning talking about there had been a massive run-up in regional centres of rents, but that seem to be reversing now, where there's actually stronger rent growth closer into the cities. So there's a bit of a pivot going on there as well.
There is, and you know, you're starting to see the, you know, the tree change and the sea change reverse a little more, people being called back to the office. It's also the fact that immigration overwhelmingly benefits the big capitals, particularly Sydney and Melbourne. But I think it's interesting because what I've done on the, with these charts here is the on the top left is the capital city average. And then I've looked around and I found some other regions where rents are either stagnating at a, on a quarterly basis or they're falling. And I think that it's interesting to see that these, you know, these regional areas, even Darwin, which, you know, you could, whether you consider it regional or not, it's up to you, but you're starting to see these rent increases stall and in some cases reverse. So I think that is what really what sort of lays ahead in the sense that eventually you can't get more blood from a stone and tenants will just either move elsewhere, move home, or move into share houses. And, you know, we'll sort of see a resumption of the, you know, the pre-COVID demographics in that regard.
Yeah, and Darwin thing's very interesting. I was doing a one-on-one the other day with somebody, and we were talking about the rental dynamics in Darwin and how far rental growth has reversed, which, you know, they were a bit surprised about. They hadn't sort of seen that that had happened, and it happened quite quickly because there'd been quite strong growth previously. But it goes back to this fundamental sort of shift in terms of, you know, where people want to live and where people choose to live. So it really puts another spanner in the works in terms of trying to read what's going on.
Yeah, exactly. It's just one more complication. And, you know, I think realistically in terms of these rents, I think they're probably going to, they're going to flow through anyway. And if the kind of crazy thing is that if the lag that we're seeing in the rents is, you know, emblematic, shall we say, of what we're going to see in the months and years ahead, we could be sitting here 2 years from now talking about the rental inflation that we're talking about right now, and that is when it feeds into the CPI properly. You know, that is well and truly on the table because it should have fed in by now, but it hasn't. And historically, you know, analysis from, you know, IFM, NAB, you know, all that sort of thing, that they've shown that, you know, yes, it should have fed in, but it hasn't. So, you know, how much longer is this rental aspect going to keep pushing up on inflation? Because if even if it's only 0.5% or 0.8%, you know, year on year, that's still enough to really, really put a spanner in the works for Phil Lowe and the RBA.
Absolutely. Big spanner and mighty big works. And it's worth saying, of course, again, that there's a difference between the new rents, which are significantly high, and the, if you like, the latent pool of rents, because people already had an agreement in place and it won't actually reset every year or every 2 years or whatever. I had somebody tell me about one place where they had an agreement that was going to be a two-year fixed rental period, and then the landlord came and tried to actually change it after 6 months. Right. So, hang on. Contract? Well, depends, I suppose. But the argument was, well, things have changed and do you still want to live in the place or not? So, you know, it sort of highlights some of the dynamics that are going on.
Oh, I'm just overwhelmed with that level of, you know, understanding and generosity. Okay, now we're just talking about the Aussie labour market before, and I did a little Twitter poll earlier today on when my followers think we'll start to see rising unemployment. And the consensus seems to be Q2 2023. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts, Martin, on when you think we'll start to see weakness in the labour market play out, you know, to the point we're actually starting to see consistent job losses in the ABS numbers.
Yeah, well, my own view is it's going to take a few months. I would expect the second quarter is likely to be when we'll start to see it. There's a couple of reasons for that. One is that we know that there's still very tight demand for labour out there at the moment, and there are still firms seeking people who they can't find to get the, you know, the people they want. Secondly, of course, the migration is going to continue to drip feed people in, and that's going to lift the unemployment rate, simply because we lost nearly 500,000 people through COVID. So that's one of the reasons why the unemployment rate's so low. So you'd expect it to be coming back up. The third thing is, if the wage claims are actually going to be stronger because of the inflation pressure and therefore people wanting to actually argue for, you know, more bargaining power, such as the new legislation could actually bring, you might well find that there's actually an upward spike in terms of the wage bill. And so one of the things that some firms will do is to stop hiring to try and deal with that. So I think those things will work through, but I reckon it'll be probably quarter two, quarter three before we really see the impact.
Yeah, I tend to think, you know, sometime in Q3 will be when we start to see, well, I think we'll start to see weakness in probably late Q1, Q2. And then I think we'll start to see things, you know, roll over more profoundly, you know, end of Q2, start of Q3, maybe a little bit later, depending on how things play out, or maybe earlier, depending on if we start to see, you know, a more pronounced global slowdown.
Yeah.
But I think it's going to be interesting. And then on the left here, we've got the Seek New Job Ads Index, and that's falling, you know, in terms of the number of new jobs. But by the same token, when you have an unemployment rate at or near 50-year lows, well, there's not really any much point putting up more ads for people, because there's only so many people left in the labor pool who don't already have a job. So, you know, I think that that's an interesting little indicator, but I don't think it's at the level yet where you would call it a forward-looking indicator that is indicating a, you know, a contractionary labor market.
No, I tend to agree for that very similar reason, that, you know, the unemployment rate's so low that there's issues trying to get anybody. And so that will actually determine much more how people go about it. And I guess the other point with all of these things is that aggregate data doesn't necessarily tell you fully what's going on. There are some differences I'm seeing in my surveys in different locations, particularly the larger areas compared with some of the regional areas. I'm already seeing some of the regional areas, some really struggling. And I'll overlay just the floods and some of the other recent natural disasters, which are having huge impacts on small businesses in some of those regional areas, and even flowing on into the farming areas. So, for example, we're seeing some farming communities not actually now taking a harvest because it's all underwater. So they don't need to employ people. So, I mean, there's a lot of dynamics under the water.
Yeah. No, and I think you made an important point regarding the wage issue. Now, one of the things I think is very interesting is that, you know, you look at, say, for example, the rental market, right? And there's this idea that if there's rising costs, landlords will pass on the rising cost of, you know, of servicing that debt onto their tenants. Now, I would, you know, counter that by saying yes, 100%, if they have the leverage to do so. But it makes me wonder if people are going to start to see, you know, these big, you know, increases in the cost of their mortgage, particularly as, you know, this huge number of people rolls off these fixed loans in the new year. It's possible that we could start to see these people demanding bigger and bigger wage increases to try and cover that rising cost in their cost, you know, that rising aspect of their cost of living. So, you know, I really do wonder, you know, if we could see that particular dynamic play out, you know, say in the first half of next year, while the labor market is still tight and the economy is still going relatively okay.
Well, I think the parallel there with the UK is quite interesting, because they have now wall-to-wall strikes planned over the next few weeks. And there are a number of wage claims now in at the current inflation rate, which is around 10%. And it's for the same argument that they don't have enough spare people to meet the job. So unemployment's still very low. And that actually puts then upward pressure on wages. And there's a big debate going on in the UK about to what extent should, for example, public sector employees actually get any wage increase. They're offering them about 2% on average, which is so far below the 10% inflation rate as to be, well, stupid. But on the other hand, you know, in the private sector in particular, wages have gone up very strongly because the private sector isn't controlled as much. And there's huge demand to try and actually get people to continue to provide the resources that are required into the sector. So there's a huge level of contention there. I wonder whether we're going to say the same here next year.
I do wonder that too. I mean, I think that we have seen, even, you know, so far, that you have seen a reasonable divergence between, you know, these more high-paid, high-in-demand jobs, where as at the lower end, you know, maybe some people haven't done as well. So, you know, I think it's going to be quite interesting, because, I mean, I'm still of the belief that broadly speaking, that wages in Australia are going to come out significantly weaker than in the rest of the world, because we do have that vacuum cleaner, you know, economy based on, you know, the housing market sucking in all that capital. So, but, you know, but like we talked about last week, last fortnight, I should say, that it's entirely possible that I'm incorrect and that we could start to see wages take off. And there are those, arguably, the fuel there for that to occur. So, you know, once again, it's going to be an interesting 2023.
Indeed.
Now, I took the APRA data and put together this, and basically it shows that in terms of rolling 12-month savings from Australian households, that they're still saving at about double the level they were prior to the pandemic. So, you know, without in actually spending the savings that they have and merely just reducing them back to where they were at the start of the pandemic, you could easily see Australian households continue to spend. Now, I should very much emphasize that this is an aggregate measure, and this is, and I would imagine this overwhelmingly favors more affluent, more higher income households, but it shows that in aggregate, households could continue to spend even with the backdrop of rising rates in overall terms, even while, you know, that third of households that Martin frequently mentions is driven to the wall and struggles quite badly.
Yeah, and it's worth, again, reflecting on that disaggregated view. Equity, of course, equity drawdowns are still going on like you wouldn't believe, going along like crazy for those refinancing, seeing it still very strong in my numbers. That tends to be those who have more equity in their property, obviously, and they can just pull more out despite property prices falling. And there is still a hangover from the COVID supports and even the superannuation pull down that people had, and that's still there in the background. But the spending momentum is really quite strong. And what I find interesting in my data is that you've got this one third who are really trapped now with almost no capacity to spend and, you know, struggling to make mortgage or rent payments. At the other end, you've got people still very willing to spend and able to spend, and they've got the money sitting in the bank to do it. And you've got the guys in the middle who are actually trying to work out how much they can afford to spend, how quickly they've got to trim back the sales because of the rate rises and all of those things. So there's a lot of dynamics going on in those three groups that actually, at an aggregate level, probably are missed when you actually look just at the top line number.
Yeah, no, I concur. And I think the thing is that, actually, we're to the next slide because it relates to this. I think that if you look at this, there is scope for Australian households to keep spending. You look at, you know, this is credit card debt as a percentage of GDP. Aussies could easily pull in another $30 billion in credit card debt and just, you know, whack it on the old credit card, and they'd still be roughly where they were prior to the global financial crisis. So I think that we've got this really, really interesting situation with one really big question. Are Australians similar enough to Americans that they will keep spending by reducing their savings and by turning to credit? Because if the answer is yes, and I'm not saying that it is, I'm not sure, to be completely honest, but if the answer is yes, you could see, you know, inflationary pressures continue well into next year, even if you are seeing those other households, you know, really in a bad way financially.
Yeah, and I was talking to Steve Meckenbecker from Canstar yesterday, the show I put up yesterday, and he said that there's been a 35% increase in new applications for credit cards in the last quarter.
Wow. Well, you know, that's really quite interesting, because that's somewhat emblematic of some of the other data that I've seen recently, just from the RBA, that we're seeing, you know, these record increases, record month-on-month increases on a seasonal basis, for the level of outstanding credit card debt. So, you know, I think Australians, you know, sort of fell out of love with the credit card somewhat, you know, over the last decade or so, you know, with the rise of buy now, pay later, etc. But I think that we're now seeing it become, you know, what are they, you know, the mother of necessity, so to speak. You know, people are just doing what they have to do to get by.
And looking at my data again, the number of additional credit cards is much more significant down in that bottom third and dribbling over into the middle third. The ones at the top, they're not using credit cards as much as they were. They've still got plenty of money around, so they're not actually in the same boat. But the trouble is that the people who are actually most exposed to the risk of debt and therefore the risk of default are the very people who are just grabbing the extra credit card or buy now, pay later, or even payday loan to try and get by. And of course, that leads to a bigger problem, because effectively you've got debt piled on debt piled on debt, and of course credit card debt is, well, very expensive.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's going to be what really sort of defines 2022, these factors. Sorry, not 2022, 2023. You know, because if we do see that continued spending, if we do see just enough, I mean, I think what needs to be put into perspective is a declining retail sector is not necessarily, in a declining retail sector in real terms, I should say, it's not necessarily going to be enough to drive down inflationary pressures.
Yep.
In retails, the retail sector is still well above trend, well above where it would have been if it just had have continued at the pre-COVID trend. Even if you give it the most heroic, taking it all the way back to the early, 2010s when it was actually performing really well and not the crap growth we had pre-COVID. But, so some form of mean reversion to the trend was always going to happen in that regard. But if you look at the US, in inflation-adjusted terms, retail spending peaked in April of 2021. Yet, only now are you starting to see, those issues with retail inflation starting to come down and starting to, in some cases, in a few places on a month-on-month basis, starting to reverse. And here, you're talking about something that happened over 18 months ago. So, this idea that retail weakens, inflation weakens very swiftly, I don't think that really sort of works in the current environment, unless, of course, it's occurring with the backdrop of something greater occurring on a global scale.
Yeah, and as I said, there are still one-third of households who are very willing and able to spend. And I suppose if you're thinking from a monetary policy setting perspective, at the aggregate level, it's in one place, but then if you actually lift rates higher, how does that impact the different types of households? Because it's the people who are actually not spending that much at the moment who will probably spend even less. But if the guys at the top still are able to continue to spend, it might actually not dent the number at all. So we could see still much higher inflation than everybody expects because, people can still spend.
Yeah, and therein lies the issue. I mean, I think it's interesting that now we start to see these arguments that, monetary policy doesn't work properly because it only targets a small percentage of the population. Well, duh. That's been obvious for ages. Of course it doesn't work. It doesn't work in the same way that it used to. I mean, it's obvious. It didn't work when they were slashing rates. Why would it work? Why would it work, as swiftly now? But, by the same token, now we're stuck in the situation where, you've got a hammer, so everything looks like a nail. So they're just going to keep doing what they're doing in reverse. But I do agree that they do need to look at things a bit more closely and look at it and go, maybe we should try something different. Maybe we should, target the rate cuts at businesses rather than households and keep rates higher either through some form of macroprudential measures or just keep rates higher in general. Just because, it discourages that those sorts of, stupid risks and all that other sort of thing. And it gives people, say, for example, retirees, it gives them the ability to be able to, fund their lives rather than get a pittance from the bank as well as they were pre-COVID.
Well, that's a very, very significant point you just made, because one of the things coming through my surveys now are those people who have savings in the banks and beginning to switch them to higher rate term deposits. So they've actually got more disposable income than they had 6 months ago, right? So it goes back to, not everybody's behaving the same way. 4 to 5% available now. And that's enough to make quite a considerable difference, bearing in mind that a year ago they were at 0.1, 0.2 or 0.5% if you were lucky. So that another source of upward momentum in the economy, which again, I'm not sure the RBA has really factored into its overall thinking.
Yeah, I would really, really dearly love to see the aggregate impact of rising rates, because obviously you've got the fact that on one hand, it's going to be sucking in all this additional capital in terms of higher mortgage rates, but then it's also spitting out higher amounts of capital because of higher savings rates. And I'd really love to know how that nets out, because it's all and good for me to go on the RBA website and go through, okay, what's the average rate payable, blah, blah, blah. But that doesn't tell me in net terms the impact that rate rises are having, because as you say, there is that other side of the ledger.
And the ratio is roughly 2-1, right? So there are actually about twice as many people who are actually impacted by the savings than the mortgages. It's just that the amount is not necessarily that big, but it's much more broadly spread.
That's an interesting point. I mean, I would really, really dearly love to say that, because all the data that we have is it's all like, oh, well, this is going to cost households, I think about $47 billion extra compared with where it was before they started raising rates, something like that on an average aggregate basis. But, if you're talking about, savers getting an extra 5, 10, 15 billion. Yes, that's significantly less, but it also minimizes the blow. So, yeah, it's going to be really interesting to watch.
It's a rotational thing, right? So what you're finding is that different segments of the economy are behaving differently. And as I say, it's quite broad-based. That's quite interesting. And it's just, you know, worth just, again, underscoring for people who are watching the show that I think about 32% of households overall have some sort of mortgage, right? But that means that there's a greater proportion of people who don't, either because they're renting or because they own their property outright. And quite a proportion of those who own their property outright are also the very people who actually are saving and have significant savings too. So it goes again to this idea that you can't just look at the aggregate. You've got to come down. And you almost need a different interest rate setting for each of the cohort groups to be able to actually manage it more effectively. But without a central bank digital currency, you can't do that. With one, you might be able to.
Yeah, I'm just going to say we should just avoid that altogether and just leave the central bank digital currency thing alone.
Fair enough.
Because I think in all likelihood, it ends not well.
Well, just to say that there's a paper just come out in the Bulletin this time, which is talking about some of the issues around it. So people want to find out more about that, go and read the Bulletin.
No worries. Now, I quite like this one because it illustrates nicely just how, what do they call it, TINA, which stands for There Is No Alternative, how that changes as interest rates rise. Now, this is from ANZ in New Zealand, and basically it shows that as term deposit, as rates fall, rental yields fall. So all that capital tries to find a home. But then as rates rise, the capital does find a different home in the bank, in a term deposit. So if people, you know, if you're looking at down, you know, the barrel at a scenario where you've got the choice between an investment property with a yield that isn't all that fantastic, with all, and obviously these are gross yields, not net yields. You've still got all the various costs. You've got strata, you've got maintenance, you've got agents, mortgage, blah, blah, blah. But it just goes to show that potentially it's changing the calculus for investors, particularly for the ones in the older demographics, people who are getting close to retirement. They're not going to be benefiting as much from things like negative gearing. So it raises an interesting question going forward that if you can go to AMP or you can go to Judo Bank or whoever it is who's got a almost 5% term deposit, well, does it really make all that much sense to be investing in the property market? If you're in that particular demographic where you're not going to see those same level of benefits, you know, and I think that's going to be a question a lot of investors are going to be asking themselves going forward.
Yeah, well, two observations. My own personal story is I went for a 4.95% term deposit quite recently because I thought, well, that's a pretty good number and it's easy money. So, you know, maybe I'm in that demographic. But the other one is that we're seeing a smaller stock of investment properties on the market. So the total pool of investment properties is dropping. It's about 20% lower than where it was a couple of years ago for the very reason you just articulated, because now people cannot make sense of it as an investment, because essentially you are banking on capital appreciation to make a property investment decision work for you. And with property prices now sideways or down, with the net returns on investment properties quite often well below 1% and quite often negative. In fact, look at my data at a postcode level. There are a number where you are in negative territory in net in yield terms, right? So you're losing money. And if you're not getting capital appreciation, you're going backwards completely. Now, okay, you could say, well, a 4.95% or whatever it is on a term deposit is still below inflation, but it's a hell of a lot better than a net investment yield that's minus.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that's an important point. I mean, it's also dependent on timelines as well. I mean, if you're, you know, in a particular age demographic and you're looking on a shorter timeline than someone who's buying a property for 10, 15 or 20 years, obviously it's going to be quite a bit different. Because if you're looking at things and you're going, okay, well, property prices could go sideways for 5 years and you're in that demographic where you're no longer going to be benefiting from those various tax concessions, et cetera, you know, past that point or towards the end of that point, that, you know, almost 25% from the old term deposit on a 5-year term deposit, all of a sudden starts to look pretty good, yep. You know, and there are obviously, you know, potentially other options in that vein as well. And, it's also just, you know, how things are going to evolve in the next, you know, 12 or 18 months. I mean, if we do say, for example, see share prices come down, you know, all of a sudden you go, well, why would I borrow money from the bank in order to be able to, you know, have an investment property when I can just own the bank instead? Yep. Or own the miner, or own the whatever it is, you know, with the dividends and all that. And that's something that's very appealing to retirees here in Australia.
And especially with the government guarantee at $250,000 per institution, right? Which means that effectively it's more secure than pretty much any other form of savings.
Safer than houses, mate.
A lot safer than houses.
Now, this is an interesting little chart that's been sort of put forward as a indicator of a coming global slowdown, possibly even a global recession. We have seen the volume of containers flowing from China to the US fall by 21% since August, and this is only through till the end of November. So, well, you are starting to see global trade volumes come down. The number, the level of manufacturing orders from American companies to Chinese factories is down by 40%. So this is going to have a couple of interesting things, a couple of interesting impacts, I should say. You're going to see global trade decelerate. You're going to see the global economy decelerate. But I think in time, this also means that you're going to see the inventory glut that has been run up over the last 9 to 12 months in particular start to reverse. You're going to start to see those inventories come down, and we will see goods disinflation, possibly even deflation in certain categories of goods within the CPI. But depending on how quickly global trade reverses, that could be a deciding factor as to how long that particular headwind acts on the CPI. And it may end up being a lot less protracted than a lot of people think.
Yeah, good point. Interestingly, I was reading the other day that a lot of the issues to do with the container flows is there are lots of containers in the wrong place, a lot of empty containers in the wrong place. So actually, they're actually skipping ports and, you know, doing all sorts of things to try and deal with the fact that the whole supply chain thing is still not working very well, but it's now not where it was. It's just lots of empty containers.
Yeah, that is definitely a factor. And you know, I think that's going to be something that's going to take quite a while to resolve, because the issue is also just part of one of the biggest issues with the container aspect of things in terms of, you know, say for example, flows between China and the US is because the Chinese consumer has been on their knees now for the best part of 18 months on and off. You haven't seen the same level of flow of goods to China from the West and from the rest of the world. So you're seeing all these containers being shipped from China to, say, Australia, the US, to Europe, etc. But then because of the fact that the Chinese consumer economy is so weak, as you say, there's empty containers flowing back. So it's a rather interesting thing that I imagine is going to continue for quite some time. But by the same token, it's going to be interesting to see how the Chinese consumer performs once, you know, with all these reopening stuff, as to, you know, how true it all ends up being.
Well, certainly the latest on the reduction of lockdowns and, you know, the end of COVID zero so quick has surprised a lot of people. And they're sort of explaining that, well, you know, it's behaving differently so they can do it. So they're trying to find an alibi as to why they're doing what they're doing. But the economic consequences could be quite significant. Although I suspect, again, it's going to be probably a bit different from what many people were thinking. So, again, another level of uncertainty.
Yeah, indeed. I think that the Chinese consumers are still in a – Chinese households, I should say, are still in a relatively bad place. I mean, you know, all you have to do is speak to someone from, say, somewhere like Melbourne, you know, who struggled through lockdown after lockdown after lockdown over a protracted period. And we in Australia – faced that with support from the government. You know, we faced that with JobKeeper. We faced that with various other support mechanisms that are introduced, you know, at a state and a federal level. China doesn't have those same things. You know, people, you know, that there are degrees of support, but it's a hell of a lot less than in the West. And I think this idea that all Chinese consumers are just going to get out there and party like it's 1999 isn't it doesn't hold water. I think that people are going to be repairing balance sheets. They're going to be, you know, because they don't know. I mean, things went great in China for a while there. I mean, I remember, you know, the pool parties in Wuhan. It was like, you know, at the end of 2020, everyone was all, oh, I wish it could be like China in terms of, you know, the way that they had their freedoms back. But then it changed. And then the same thing happened again. And I think that we are going to see, you know, a level of hesitation and just concern that things could go back to being the way they were, you know, a few weeks ago. So I don't think it's as clear cut as it's made out to be.
No, and the other point there is that if in fact they do open up, then they're going to find a significant spike in infections, and that's going to have huge knock-on effects in terms of, you know, medical services and all sorts of things. And you know, a bit like some of the things we went through in Australia when, in fact, you know, the spread of the virus started to pick up again. So I'm not sure that's fully factored into people's thinking yet as to how this all plays out.
No, and it's a complex thing because they can't have the same level of deaths as the West. They need to be able to say we did better. And they, I mean, in a credible, plausible way. I mean, yes, obviously they can massage the statistics and they can do all sorts of things that authoritarian governments can do, but it still needs to be able to ring true to a reasonable degree for it to be believed by the public. So, you know, I think that to sort of go back on the theme of today's show, it's a lot more complex than it initially appears.
I agree.
Now, used cars are just in the US are arguably the be-all and end-all at this point in terms of one of the major drivers of inflation and, you know, in a lot of places, in a lot of quarters, the hope for a deflationary factor in the US CPI. And they sort of didn't really meet with the normal script in November. They actually only fell very, very marginally. So it's going to be quite interesting to see how the used car market fares, because if it's going to be this slow grind down rather than this trip down the elevator shaft, it's going to be a much less severe drag on the US CPI, particularly core CPI, than some people, including myself, have considered it being.
Now, that's very interesting, because another uncertainty factor, right? So if it's not behaving the way that people expected it was going to behave, and maybe it's something to do with the fact that still people are quite employed, that wages growth is quite strong in the US, one of the reasons why the Fed's concerned. So maybe there's more money sloshing around the system, and that perhaps means that people are still able and willing to trade used vehicles. So another very important one to watch.
Indeed, and we'll get to that a little bit more in the next slide, because What I've done here is, and I'm currently putting together about 8 or 10 different scenarios for the US used car market. Well, it's actually more like 16 if you count the fact I'm doing it over 12 and 18 months. But anyway, a bunch of different scenarios on basically how much it could drag on the CPI. And if we do, say, for example, see a nominal mean reversion in US used car prices, which basically means them falling to where they were pre-COVID. Now, I don't personally think that's going to happen, mostly because we have seen such significant levels of wage growth and we do still have these issues with, you know, supply chains and people getting cars in time, et cetera. You know, obviously this is, you know, if the economy implodes, it's going to be a different story. But, you know, based on just a simple mean reversion, you're talking about potentially, you know, off, this is off core CPI, you know, potentially down as much as 1.7%. And that's basically, you know, at this point, well over a quarter of the entire US core CPI. So if it does, if the US used car market does detonate, it could be a huge, huge headwind to the CPI. But this is where things get interesting. If it does drag on the CPI, it's eventually going to be this huge base effect.
Yep.
You're going to have this, you know, this huge drag on the CPI, which is eventually just going to fade out over time. So it could really trick people and the Fed into thinking that inflation is weaker than it actually is at an underlying level. And that brings us back to the inflationary yo-yo situation, whereby you could see a meltdown, Fed cuts, stimulus, monetary and fiscal, and then things like this mask simmering core inflation, and then bang, not too long later, you've got inflation taking off again and you're right back where you started.
And I think you can make a similar argument for rents in the US too, as being potentially another factor is going precisely down the same road.
Yeah, exactly. And interestingly, on rents, something that I've seen in terms of survey data, rather than, because you know, there's Zillow, there's Apartmentlist, there's all these others who do asking rents, much in the same way that you see here in Australia with SQM, Domain, etc. But there's been some very interesting survey data on existing rents and those rents rising. And while we've started to see asking rents get cut, actual payable rents for existing leases, which have now been revised upwards, those are still rising and they're still being renegotiating high. Because what you've seen is you've seen this divergence. On one hand, you've seen asking rents take off. On the other hand, you've seen actual rents payable and ones that are being adjusted higher occur at a much lower level. But the CPI hasn't taken into account either of them to the degree that it has actually occurred yet. So even though we're starting to see, in some cases, falling month on month or even quarter on quarter rents from, you know, the private providers in terms of new rents, you're still starting to see those the stock, rather than the flow, continuing to rise. So that could be a really, really interesting one to watch going forward.
Yep, I agree. And another cause of uncertainty.
Yeah, exactly, mate. Now, I've taken US core inflation between 1980 and the end of 1982 here, and basically it's just to illustrate that inflation ebbs and flows over time. Different drivers pass off to different drivers, and you see highs, you see lower lows. And it's also worth noting that this is core inflation back in the 80s when they used to measure it properly. Before they changed things, and then inflation got a whole lot lower in terms of the way they measured it because of the way the metrics and the weights changed. So I think this is just a little bit of an emblematic thing as to how things can vary quite significantly. And still, inflation, if the conditions warrant it, roars back to life.
Yeah, and just to say, it's from 80 to 82, right? So it's a very early story. As you say, when they measured it properly.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think that, you know, we just need to be careful. You know, like a lot of people, you know, say, for example, we've seen a few months of retail here and there in Australia. We've seen a few weak inflation prints here and there in Australia. And a lot of people have just, you know, declared victory. And then inflation just comes back. And that's what we saw in one of the first charts in today's show, whereby the Melbourne Institute gauge just went, you know, third highest reading ever. So, you know, it does ebb and flow over time, and it's very, very difficult to nail down when you've actually killed inflation, you know, which is why, say, someone like the former Fed chair, Paul Volcker, was so, you know, we've got to kill this thing, you know, and rather than, you know, this sort of more wishy-washy attitude that you perhaps see from some central banks these days.
Yeah, and it typically takes 12 to 18 months before you really know whether you've done it or not.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know, even someone like Arthur Burns waited, you know, nine months of rising unemployment before he declared, you know, didn't so much declare victory, but cut rates and, you know, sort of thought that they had it under control, but they didn't. No. So, you know, I don't know if any major central banker has the balls for that these days to wait for even 9 months, let alone the 12 or 18 months that may be warranted to be sure that it's actually dead.
No, well, there's political pressure, and then there's market pressure, and then there is what the Fed or the other central banks believe they can get away with. But, you know, the message is pretty clear, isn't it, that inflation is something we have to crush, we have to kill it off. And, in fact, the messages are more underscored, we have to fix this, as time's gone on and as inflation has continued to be a problem. So I don't know. I mean, how long is the fuse that they've got before they actually have to do something different? I don't know.
Yeah, no, I don't know either. I mean, I think that it's going to depend on how long things hold up. And that's why I think we did see this huge, you know, front loading of interest rates, because they knew that if they front loaded it, they had the best chance of killing it. And that, I think, is really something that's quite interesting here in Australia, that despite the fact that we've got this, that these fixed rates insulating people and stuff like that. Because, you know, we talk about the impact of how it's going to screw things up in terms of people reverting to variable. But I think there's also the side of things where people are insulated from rising rates. Now, if the RBA had gone hard, like the RBNZ, perhaps we'd be further down the road on the fight against inflation than we are now. But they raised rates, what was it, eight months later than the Reserve Bank of New Zealand did.
Absolutely. Or another way of thinking about it, folks, is if you want inflation to stay higher for longer, spend more.
Yeah, pretty much, right? Atlanta Fed wage growth has re-accelerated just a little bit, particularly for job switches. And I mean, even if you sort of, you know, talk about some of these old rules of thumb that people have put forward now, they're not, whether or not how exactly accurate they are is another matter entirely. But, you know, say, for example, you know, people say you can have wages growth, you know, 1.5% higher than the rate of inflation. This sort of speaks to a level of inflation of about 4%, which is something that Jim Bianco has made a point that he's made quite a few times, which I think is a reasonably good one. And, you know, I mean, naturally, we're still, you know, sort of flying blind here. But, you know, I think that this does go to show that you could continue to see, you know, inflationary pressures remain quite strong in the US based on wages growth.
Well, I find it interesting that the job switching number is so much higher. So, and I've spoken to a number of people here in Australia who've switched jobs and have got a 15% increase by doing it. So, you know, depending on the industry that you're in and all of those things and the qualifications, it is feasible to get a significant leg up. But of course, a lot of people don't have that facility. They're in the public sector. They've got more limited choice. And so this is one of the reasons why public sector and private sector wages in Australia is diverging.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Okay. Now, for those of you who can't read German like me.
Let me guess, warm temperature, cold temperature.
Yes, yes, believe it or not. I managed to figure that one out all by my lonesome too. But basically this just shows that Europe is relying on the weather. Mm. If it starts to see colder temperatures like the ones we've seen during the winter of 2010, they're basically going to run out of gas. Unless they cut gas to various different high usage industries and et cetera. So, you know, basically you could see, you know, a significant portion of German industrial capacity and industrial capacity throughout other countries in Europe basically close because they don't have the gas to keep them open and get through the winter. So it's going to kind of go down to the wire. It's going to be an interesting sort of little thing because, you know, you could get the warmer outcome like in 2020 and it might not be so bad and they'll have more than enough. Or there's the opposite, you know, where they run out of, where they get close to running out and they have to cut production.
Well, I can tell you at the moment, Europe is actually experiencing extremely cold weather because they've got a big Arctic surge of cold air coming down. I was talking to someone in the UK and they had a -6 overnight. That's centigrade, not Fahrenheit, -6, which is almost unheard of for this time of year. It's, you know, December. It's normally sort of muggy and cold rather than really, really cold.
Freezing.
Yeah, it's sort of just, you know, wet and cold and dark. But the point there is that that cold splodge of air is drifting over towards Europe, and now they're suggesting that in fact it's going to be very cold quite early. And as you say, that then plays into the and what happens to the gas supplies when everybody turns up the heating.
Yeah, and it's amazing just how bullish people are on Europe at the moment. You look at the performance of the German DAX index, which is their stocks, or even the euro relative to the US dollar. I mean, it's been very, very bullish recently.
Yep.
But it's kind of strange when you're basing bullish on the weatherman.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, well, they did have a nice warm autumn, so that was sort of helpful, but unfortunately it's getting a bit colder now, so one to watch. And of course the cost of gas has gone up and down, up and down, and the forward views is now it's going to go up again. So that's going to have another impact in terms of the whole economic question as well as the supply question.
Indeed. And the last chart of the day, people. Basically, this is a breakdown of various different aspects of the Chinese economy via their PMI. So you've got manufacturing, services, and construction. Now, as you can see, construction is still performing very, very strongly. And despite the fact that that we've seen the property sector get smashed by various different restrictions and, you know, tightening of credit, etc., it's still the construction sector overall is still performing very, very well. And I think this illustrates nicely just how China can pivot between, and I got that word triggers some people, pivot, moves between the construction activity for housing and the construction activity for infrastructure. Because this illustrates nicely that you have already seen the stimulus. Yep. And even if we do start to see an uptick in the property sector and you do start to see a surge there, which there's no guarantee of, but if that does happen, then you're just going to see the infrastructure side of things take a bit of a breather and, you know, just they're going to aim for that more sustainable level of growth. So I think it's a little bit premature for people to think that China reopening means commodity demand to the moon. However, the market doesn't really care about that in a lot of cases. So it may mean commodity prices to the moon, but not necessarily commodity demand in terms of, and I'm talking about bulks here. So like coking coal, iron ore, et cetera, copper, different story.
Absolutely. And, you know, the bottom line could be that the overall GDP growth for China, while it comes up a little, may not actually reach the heady heights that we had a few years ago, which effectively supported pretty much the whole of the economy globally.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't think they've done the official target yet, but they're talking about a target of around 5%. And now, rather than it being, you know, this set in stone sort of thing, it's this, you know, more sort of rubbery figure. And I think that gives them a bit more scope to be, you know, a little bit more conservative with things. And not only that, but just the fact that the Chinese consumer economy is reopening at all should see GDP rise reasonably strongly all on its own. So it's not necessarily as bullish as the sort of mainstream narrative would suggest for commodities, you know, bulk commodities, I should say. I mean, you've got the issues with, say, like copper, aluminium, the low levels of inventories are, that's going to make life quite difficult in terms of, you know, keeping prices low. I think that there's quite a bullish story in that particular avenue.
Well, considering the demand for electronics and, I suppose even some of the energy sector, some of the renewables need those sort of technologies to be able to actually run them. So it's going to be very interesting. So, you know, as we sort of come to the end of the year, 2022 was a very bumpy, shocking year with the change in interest rates. But I have to say that I think 2023 is going to be a bumpy year. And there are so many variables that it makes it quite hard to make a call as to where things are going to go. But I have to say I'm probably more expecting the RBA to lift rates above where CBA thinks they're going to go. And I think we're going to have quite a wobbly year. And I think in the second half of the year, we'll start to see some of the early impacts with regards to the mortgage pressures and those things coming through, lower growth. I think wages growth will probably be higher than many people expect, but that's partly to do with the switching of different jobs and those sorts of things. But the cost of living, I think, will stay high for long, and that's going to be a significant pressure on many households.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting one. I mean, I think that we are going to see the economy roll over probably in the second half of next year. I think that, you know, that's something that I said on Twitter a couple of days ago. But I think the global story could really be a big driver here, and also that how things play out in China, because, you know, if the, you know, the much vaunted reopening doesn't result in this extremely bullish economic story that everybody's hoping for, and you do, and we, you know, I mean, because there's just going through the slideshow, if Europe does have that cold winter, if all these different things come together, you know, you could see things start to, you know, fall apart globally, more sooner than the second half of next year. It could happen a lot faster. But then by the same token, if things do turn out relatively okay, it could, you know, you could start, you know, say for example, like the US economy, it could be okay for, you know, another quarter, maybe two, you know, before you start to see, I mean, like say for example, job openings are still up in a reasonably decent place. It will roll over. I don't doubt that. That'll happen next year, but it all comes down to when. And that's going to influence the market, and that's going to influence how high rates have to go.
Yeah, well, I always think it takes longer for these things to work through than many people expect. And, you know, I remind everybody that some of the academic research suggests that it takes up to 18 months for interest rate movements, monetary policy movements to really work through and really be apparent in all the data. So don't be surprised if it takes a few more months than many people expect. And, you know, you shouldn't necessarily expecting to see mortgage delinquencies go through the roof in the first 2 months or 3 months of next year. You shouldn't necessarily see businesses failing in the first few months, but later on next year and into 2024, that's when I think some of the real negative feedback will then show in the real data. So we'll watch the data, and I guess we'll pick up the conversation, you know, probably in the new year.
Yeah, sounds good, man. I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you very much, and have a good break. Have a good Christmas.
You too, mate.
Cheers.